Our guest speaker, Trevor Sykes, I'm pleased to say, is a good friend of mine. He is also a distinguished son of Adelaide. He was born, however, in Footscray in Victoria in 1937. Is that right? And then he was educated at Adelaide Technical High School, and he now works, of course, for the Australian Financial Review, where many of you may have followed his sybaritic lifestyle that he leads at the Croesus Club. In real life, Trevor has worked for a number of leading media organisations, like all the rest of us. He's been around the traps, including the Sun News Pictorial in Melbourne, now, of course, the Herald Sun, the Sydney Morning Herald, where I started as a copy boy, Reuters News Agency in London, and in more recent times, he has been editor of The Bulletin and a prolific contributor to that magazine. One of his minor claims to fame, of course, was giving Christopher Skase his first job at the AFR. For your next task, you can go to Mallorca. But Trevor started work, I believe I'm correct in saying, with the Advertiser and was a cadet there when Don Riddell was a senior journalist. Don can't be here today, but he sends his warmest regards to you, Trevor. And Des Cahoon, who also can't be here, says he is delighted he is in your poon and has missed you. Trevor's written some great stories about Australian business and investment and some great books. The titles of his books, I guess, give you the idea. They are The Money Miners, Village Pierpont, Two Centuries of Panic, Operation Dynasty, The Bold Riders, my favourite, and The Official History of Blue Sky Mines. Please welcome Trevor Sykes, who I hope will talk to you on the subject of Will the Bold Riders Ride Again?
Thank you, Robert, and I'm delighted to be in my hometown again. Although I was born in Footscray, that was an accident of positioning, which I have spoken to my mother about several times. I'm really an Adelaide boy, and it's still my ambition to play for the West Torrens Colts. Something will be rather difficult because West Torrens doesn't exist anymore, but the flame still burns, if you follow my meaning. When I wrote The Bold Riders, which is a history of the corporate cowboys in the 1980s, the inspiration from the title was from a verse by Edgar Allan Poe. Over the mountains of the moon, down the valley of the shadow, ride, boldly ride, if you seek for El Dorado. Well, it seemed a great description of the corporate cowboys of the 1980s. They sought El Dorado vigorously, they rode boldly everywhere, and almost all of them wound up deep down in the valley of the shadow. The question I've been asked to address today is whether we shall see their like again. And to get the answer, I'd like to go into a little history. In Australia's history, there have been two great waves of corporate collapses. The first was in the 1890s, and the second, which we've all just lived through, was in the 1980s. In between, there have, of course, been countless smaller collapses. The first company set up in Australia was the Bank of New South Wales in 1817, and it almost went broke twice in its first decade, and was only rescued by government support. The first major collapse in Australia's history was the Australian Auction Company in Sydney in 1841, followed by several other enterprises of the day as Australia entered one of the great depressions of its history. I can find you large and sensational corporate collapses in almost every decade of our history since then, and I am not here talking about small businesses. Small businesses can go broke for all sorts of reasons, some of which may well be beyond the control of the operators. Small businesses, if you like, are fragile craft which can capsize even in fairly calm seas. But once a business reaches a certain size, say in the top 200 or 300 in Australia, it is rarely brought down by factors outside its own control. It may face an ongoing decline, but in those circumstances it has the capacity to merge to do something else to save itself. You don't get, or you shouldn't get, overnight collapses. So, looking at the title of today's address again, I think it is helpful if we break it into two questions. First, will there be bold riders in the future? And secondly, will they ride as boldly as they did in the 1980s? There's ample evidence that corporate cowboys have been around for a long time. Indeed, I once wrote rather a fat book, which I advise you not to read but to use as a doorstop, called Two Centuries of Panic, in which I thought I conclusively proved that premise. Australia's first company, as I said, the Bank of New South Wales, nearly went broke within a decade of its foundation, and the prime reason was because it made too many bad loans to its own directors, or rather its own directors made too many bad loans themselves. South Australia, I am proud to say, and we can all hold our heads up here, has contributed its share of corporate cowboys. It was prominent as an early haven for speculators in the great copper boom of the 1840s, when copper mania gripped the state. In the 1880s, there was a whole rash of defalcations from enterprises as widely separated as building societies and the YMCA. And the biggest defalcations of all were committed in the Commercial Bank of South Australia, where the general manager, who delighted in the name of Crooks, had been systematically embezzling for years and speculating with spectacular lack of success in silver shares. Since World War II, this proud history has continued. There was Aussie O'Grady's Reed Murray, which collapsed in 1961, although I am not going to say a bad word about West Torrens' greatest supporter ever. There was Poseidon in 1969, and since then we have had Finance Corporation of Australia, Kia Ora, Beach Petroleum, and the State Bank of South Australia. More populous states may have produced more bold riders, but nobody can accuse South Australia of not doing its share. Joking aside, there have always been hairy operators and always will be. They are, together with over-optimists, an ineradicable part of the private enterprise system. I might also make the point that in recent times they have had rather little reason to fear the law. The justice system did not deal very convincingly with the corporate cowboys of recent times. We have just recently seen the Simon Hannes case, where the evidence seemed to me to be the clearest you could possibly get in an insider trading case, and yet it still took the jury 2 weeks to convict him. Laurie Connell, true, was jailed, but he was still fighting through the courts for his freedom when he died. Alan Bond eventually went to jail, but only after a long and determined rearguard action, which at one point included a claim that he had lost brain function and memory. And I still rank that recovery of brain functions as a modern miracle, which should get a mention somewhere in the New Testament. Brian Yule of Spedley, Ian Johns of Tricontinental, George Herskew of Hooker, and Robin Greenberg of Western Women also received long sentences, the longest going to Robin Greenberg, but only because she has started a bushfire in the process of trying to set a light to her corporate records. She got 3 years for fraud and 14 years for the bushfire. I'm not making this up. Anyway, some smaller fry got committed, but when you consider the outrageous excesses committed during the 1980s and the amounts of money lost through recklessness and fraud, the number of bold riders who went inside is very small, and the cost and difficulty of getting them there is very considerable. Today, if you strike someone in charge of a large enterprise that you want to put away, you can reckon on a total cost of about $10 million for the case. It makes justice rather prohibitive. Quite a few of the bold riders of the 80s are still running around, although some of them admittedly are doing their running in other companies and some are inhibited by the occasional forced use of wheelchairs. And meanwhile, a few new players have entered the game. I can assure you there is no shortage of corporate cowboys in small mining companies and high-tech stocks. So looking at the first question, will there be bold riders in the future? History gives us an unequivocal answer of yes. But will they ride again? It is sobering to reflect how far they rode last time. Overgeared corporate cowboys in the 1980s rose to the point where they controlled the Australian brewing industry, large chunks of the media industry, and I think nearly all of television, the retail industry they had large chunks of, and they controlled the nation's largest textile and car rental groups. Adelaide Steamship became our largest industrial group, and Bond Corporation at its zenith was the ninth largest enterprise of any kind in Australia ranked by revenue, and that includes the post office and telecom as it then was. What was unusual about the 1980s was not that we had bold riders, we've always had them as I think I've proved, it was that the bold riders had pretty well unlimited access to finance. Banks threw money at them and lost it in billions. Now, the scramble for the banks to finance corporate cowboys actually started back in the 1960s when IAC, the finance subsidiary of the ANZ, financed Alan Bond in his first property deals. Foreign banks and merchant banks followed on, and I need hardly remind this audience that state banks, with delusions of grandeur, also got into the act and became big-time lenders to corporate cowboys, some of whom were not in their own state or even their own country. But as no one was ever found guilty, I dare say I can't say anything more on that. The high point, I guess, from all this thing that had flowed through for a matter of a quarter of a century was when the ANZ loaned $2 billion to Warwick Fairfax when none of its senior officers had ever met him. He has now found his right level in the finance system by selling Bibles in Maryland. Today the banks appear to have learned their lessons. We won't really know what they've been doing until the next wave of corporate collapses arrives to test them, but meanwhile their balance sheets reflect prudence and sound provisioning, and with no evidence to the contrary, I can only assume that is the case. Now, earlier I mentioned the 1890s as the other great era of corporate collapses. Those collapses were almost entirely in real estate and finance and were centred upon Melbourne. And by the way, you have no idea what pleasure it gives a South Australian boy to stand up here and say nasty things about Melbourne which are true in front of an Adelaide audience. Very briefly, Victoria in the 1880s saw an enormous land boom. A lot of companies were formed to speculate in land. They called themselves land banks to give themselves a projection of respectability, but really they were just real estate speculators. Without exception, they were run so badly as to defy rational explanation, unless you consider them as deliberately fraudulent. In almost every case, the directors pocketed huge sums in fees, huge sums in borrowings, and huge sums in vendor considerations, even though anyone of average intelligence in their position must have known these companies were not operating profitably. Let's just run through a couple of those again. Huge sums in vendor fees, huge sums in operational fees, and they're not operating profitably. Does anything ring a bell contemporarily here? No? Well, I'll go on. Okay. Anyway, extravagant lies were told in prospectuses, and when the crunch came, all the directors would welsh shamefully on their liabilities. They issued themselves swags of part-paid shares to control companies, where the main money was put up by the public, and then they reneged on the unpaid calls when the companies hit the wall thanks to their own mismanagement and graft. And the promoters were the most prominent men in Melbourne, the most notable being the Speaker of the Legislative Assembly, Sir Matthew Davies. Those real estate speculations began to collapse in the early 1890s. So many of them collapsed that a domino effect set in, and the major trading banks in 1893, when Victoria experienced the largest financial collapse in Australia's history, resulted in wholesale bank closures everywhere, and some of them never returned. Looking back at the roots of that crisis, it occurred because too much money had been invested in the cowboy enterprises of the land banks, which were run very badly. The source of the finance was equity. The prosperous middle classes of Victoria, who had been enjoying a long boom which had been almost unbroken since the discovery of gold in the 1850s, poured their savings into the land banks on the premise that real estate prices in Melbourne would continue rising geometrically, which they didn't. And when the real estate boom stopped and the shoddy financing of the land banks was exposed, the value of them rapidly sank to zero, and that caused a domino panic into the banking system proper. Today, we are watching another stock exchange boom in progress. Over the past year, there has been a rising mania for high-tech stocks, particularly anything concerned with the internet. Share prices have lost all touch with reality, as measured by old-fashioned yardsticks such as dividend yields and price-earning ratios. Most of them don't have earnings, and almost none of them have dividends. E-Corp, with the magic name of Kerry Packer behind it, listed at around $3. That represented a market capitalisation of $1.8 billion for a stock which had only $50 million in revenue, and you can forget about earnings. Austar, from an unkind reading of its prospectus, had lost something like $700 million in the previous 4 years and wasn't going to pay a dividend in the next 4 years, but they still managed to get the stock away at $5. We are also seeing a number of moribund mining companies begin new lives as IT stocks. The premise seems to be that if someone can't make money in mining, then all they've got to do is turn into an IT stock and they become an overnight success. If you think about this for a second, it does challenge credulity. My prize in this category goes to a stock called Ocean Resources, which is currently buying a website called goalmap.com. Now, my first reaction was, gee, that sounds like it's gone into geological mapping. That might be a logical extension. But when I looked at the website, it turned out to be a map of your personal goals in life. Do you want to be rich? Do you want your mother to love you? Do you want to be sexy? Or maybe all these things. And it sets out the paths then by which you can achieve these personal goals, answering question after question. I gave up after half an hour because I wasn't dead sure that this was getting me anywhere. To me, it looked as though it was operating on the intellectual level of the Lovelorn page of New Idea magazine. But that hasn't stopped the vendors of the website, who also, by coincidence, happen to be directors of Ocean Resources, from trying to flog the website to the company in return for a swag of shares and options. Now, as an old free marketer and a great believer in the ethos of caveat emptor, I don't mind someone flogging a bag of rubbish to the punters, just as long as it's clearly tagged as a bag of rubbish. Also, if a few optimistic nerds with a bit of software design capability see the sudden chance to get rich by floating that capability as a public company and make a few million dollars, well, good luck to them, as long as they have full disclosure. And by the way, it seems to me there are about five companies floating around at the moment, which between them are going to design something like five times the websites Australia needs. One of them must be wrong. But experience tells me that when money is being made in such huge multiples and an undiscriminating new wave of investors is prepared to throw money at floats without reading the prospectuses, it won't be long before we see what I would think of as a quasi-criminal element arrive. Indeed, it has arrived already, although in front of an audience of pressies, I'm carefully not mentioning any of them by name here today. I've long had the thought that if corporate Australia were to turn honest overnight, I'd be out of a job, but that thought has never cost me a wink's sleep at night. In my capacity as Pierpont, I can tell you there are no cowboys operating on the scale of Laurie Connell or Alan Bond these days, but there's a whole heap of them in small and increasingly medium-sized companies. Every week I receive complaints from readers and tips from professionals pointing out dodgy deals down the bottom and increasingly the middle end of the market. I'm getting these tips at the rate of 3 a week, but as Pierpont is solidly committed to spending his time lunching and only writes one column a week, I'm falling behind. This boom has not been financed very much by the banking sector, if at all. It is not like the 1980s boom. It has been financed by equity, like the 1890s boom, or rather the 1880s boom. It looks far more to me like a rerun of the land bank mania of the 1890s, or the Poseidon boom of 69-70. So we have the wildest boom since Poseidon on the ASX, while the banks are out there sitting on about 8% on their loans if they're lucky. And if this situation continues long enough, history tells us some hungry bank is going to start investing, and if it's not a local one, it'll be a foreign one. That might be one of the best signals to get out, because once that starts, the money starts really going wild. It's also notable, if I can go off on a sidetrack for 1 second, that while large corporate collapses have always tended to come in waves, in modern times, the gap between the waves is tending to shorten. The first big break after World War II was triggered by the Menzies credit squeeze of 1961, which collapsed such shaky empires as Reed Murray, Stanley Corman and H.G. Palmer. That was quite a serious wave of collapses. Roughly 8 years later, it was followed by the decline of the nickel boom, which started with speculative stocks, and I include Poseidon in those, and worked onward and upward until it swept away Mineral Securities Australia and Patrick Partners, which were respectively Australia's newest large mining house and Australia's largest banking stockbroking firm. August and September of 1974, just after that, saw the worst financial panic Australia had experienced since the 1930s, as a whole series of overgeared property groups collapsed, the main ones being Home Units of Australia, Mainline Corporation and Cambridge Credit. 3 years later, 77, came another wave of property collapses as investors started runs, panic runs, on building societies in Queensland and South Australia. Old hands here will remember Don Dunstan with his loud hailer reassuring queues of investors withdrawing their money from the Hindmarsh Building Society. Another institution to collapse at that time was Commercial and General Acceptance of Australia, which was owned by the Commercial Banking Company of Sydney, which as a direct result of that is no longer with us. It got absorbed into another bank, but it was kneecapped by that particular panic. 2 years later, in 1979, we saw the collapse of Associated Securities, and as you will all remember here, the Bank of Adelaide being forced into a shotgun marriage with the ANZ. A decade later, we saw the biggest string of collapses in this century. In the 19th century, the waves of collapses tended to be further spaced out. There was never a span of 40 years with the scale of collapses we have seen in the last 40 years. And I'm not talking in dollar terms here, I'm talking on the scale of companies in proportion to their size relative to the economy at the time. In Australia today, we have commodities the 19th century never knew. We have instant coffee, instant TV meals, instant worldwide telecommunications, and where the markets are concerned, it also seems we have instant memory loss of what happened last time. One thing I have observed is that you cannot have a bust without a boom. Till you have a boom beforehand, you can't have a bust afterwards. After the recession we really didn't have to have in 1990 to 1992, the corporate world was fairly quiet as it climbed back out of the abyss. Today the pace is quicker, and the technology sector of the market is having a boom, and it will assuredly also have a bust if it is not starting to have one now. If I knew when that would happen, I wouldn't have to give speeches for a living, but happen it will. Just consider the following facts. 1. More Australians hold shares than ever before in our history, thanks to the privatisations of the Commonwealth Bank and Telstra and the demutualisation of the AMP. 2. More Australians hold shares than ever before in our history and have become new shareholders in the last 2 or 3 years. A higher proportion of those shareholders are very new shareholders. 3. Nearly all of them have either unrealised gains or realised gains and they're thinking, this is easy. How long has this been going on? Four, none of them have seen a bear market. Not what I'd call a bear market. Five, they have lots of money. There's something like, the last time I counted, $16 billion sitting around in the cash management trusts at about 3.75% waiting for an outlet that's a bit more profitable, and that explains a lot of the Russian and new floats. Six, companies are being floated on hope and hype rather than on solid earnings. You only have to look at this week, 2VSM. That had 3 years losses, which averaged $50 million a year. From memory, it was predicting a $19 million loss, and it still managed to raise something like $75 million, and it opened, surprise, surprise, on a one-third discount. Amazing. Seven, there is no way that all of the IT stocks that have launched in the past year can justify their exceedingly high multiples. And by the way, they normally talk about multiples to cash flow or revenue because they're only earnings. Eight, and you'll have to take my word for it, but as I mentioned earlier, the criminal element is appearing, which I carefully cannot name today. On my analysis, we are in bold rider territory, all right. They're not as big as they were in the 1980s, but when you consider there are floats nowadays getting around at between the 30 and 70 million mark, that's a lot of hoot. If I can be permitted to quote myself, which is the ultimate vanity for any author, at the finish of the Bold Riders, I wrote, if engineers never learned from history, every generation of students would be condemned to reinvent the wheel. But engineers and scientists do learn from history, and so we have heart transplants and men walking upon the moon. But in economics and finance, however, the human race still starts every generation with flint axes. I leave those gloomy thoughts with you. There is a game to be played out there, and in the meantime, I trust I have not ruined your lunch too much. Thank you for having me here today.
When a guest speaker brings his mum to lunch, you know he's got to be telling the truth. It's our custom, ladies and gentlemen, to direct our first questions to our media members. Do we have any questions? Judith Bleachmore has the magic microphone. Rex Jury.
Two questions not related to each other. The first is you concentrated perhaps on the stock market. Does the property market automatically follow, or is the property market a self-regulating force? And the second, what has been the impact of gambling, and particularly poker machines in some of the newer states, Victoria and South Australia, had on the marketplace, if I can use those words?
If the property market is a self-regulating force that regulates itself very badly, the property crashes of the 1970s were pretty abysmal. Normally, history tells us that property tags along after the stock market, that if you're having a stock market boom now, the property market will be somewhere like about 2 years down the track, both in the boom and the bust. That was the experience of the 70s and also partially of the 1980s. And unless things are getting more condensed than I think, that's the time frame I'd work on. But things are happening more instant these days. On gambling, when you look at day trading on the stock exchange, I don't see much difference between doing that and playing a poker machine. You absolutely lose the point of investing. You're not hanging around for a dividend. You're not looking for long-term growth. You are betting that something is going to go up in the next hour or 5 minutes. The big casino, if you like, down the big end of town, is trying to be fully competitive with the poker machines. And if you look at the rapidity with which they turn over in New York, maybe it is. I think the Productivity Commission were quite right about gambling, by the way. The way gambling has spread in Australia and developed, I regard it as a tax on the poor. It always amazes me, gambling. I mean, I'm a note holder in Crown and a shareholder in Tabcorp, okay, because that's the only sensible side of it to be. Otherwise, what are you doing out there? I mean, do you think someone's built this enormous edifice, all this glass, all this concrete, staffed it with all those people, floated a public company, just so they can lose money to you when you walk in? I mean, you only have to state the postulation and it becomes obvious what their motivation is. And the old saying, of course, is that only a sucker bets against the house, don't be a sucker, be the house. I like head-to-head games like poker, where at least you've got an even chance of winning. Where the house is going to get a take regardless, you better be on the house side, you better buy their shares.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. Trevor, I've heard it said of high-tech stocks that they've totally transformed the economy so this boom can keep going. You obviously don't agree with that. Are you predicting when the bust does come, it's going to be a decline, a correction, or a total crash? And how long have I got to sell my shares?
This afternoon would be good. Look, undoubtedly there's going to be some winners amongst this mob that are coming on the market at the moment, but they're not all going to be. From my experience of previous booms of this sort, you start off with genuine ones, then you get hitchhikers, and then you get hopefuls who just see a chance to raise a few lazy million by rushing a prospectus out. As Geoffrey Blamey once observed, the speculators who get hurt in a boom are those who arrive late, not those who arrive early. So I would tend to look around. When there's a lot of people in the same field, like their own website design, I'd be particularly worried. They can't all succeed. There was another one that worried me the other day. Oh, yeah, it was someone who'd made $1 million out of internet services last year, but next year they're going to make $27 million out of the same thing by establishing internet communities, which I thought everyone out of the internet was trying to do already. That sort of projection bothers me. So I think you've got to look at them individually. I tend to stag the lot, and I'll get back into them a year later if they're showing a bit of form. Because day one is usually a very good day. Yes, we are going into the internet. Yes, we are going into IT. Yes, there will be winners. And yes, as we've seen with computer share, for instance, the winners can pay off very handsomely. But I suggest to you that the fail rate is going to be very high, and I would suggest it's somewhere around 90%. And I think it takes a little time to work out which they are. And if you're holding 10 stocks there, nine of them might have gone down so badly that the tenth one won't pull you out of the hole.
Trevor, as a reader of your book, The Bold Riders, you didn't mention, but I think you should mention here, that at the end of it you did make a number of recommendations of what changes to the law should take place to stop the bull riders appearing together again in such a similar way. First, if you could explain what those are to this audience, but secondly, how much of the law has been changed to meet your minimum requirement to keep the next generation of bull riders in some sort of control?
My main recommendation in that book, because it had been a matter of 10 years earlier and two centuries of panic, was that we try to streamline the legal system. This has been talked about, I dare say, since the legal system started with amazing lack of success. But I thought where large company collapses and large company cases occurred, we could have something that amounted to a coronial system or a juge advocate system, where instead of everyone attacking it from different angles, you had an investigating judge or an investigating QC. The investigation bit is usually the easy bit. You look at a company that collapses and someone like Ian Ferrier or John Harkness gets in there as a liquidator, they can usually find out in a matter of 5 days what's gone wrong there primarily. They're very good at these sort of things. And they then hand on their findings to the regulators, and the regulators are renowned these days for doing nothing about it. My idea was that you have a judge advocate for corporate collapses, that he conducts it with an open mind as a coronial inquiry, and that he has the power to make orders along the way. On the criminal side, he can make orders for committal on the grounds that he has unearthed evidence that amounts to fraud, and there's always some degree of fraud in there. or not always, but often enough. And secondly, he would also have the power to, and by the way, on the criminal side, I would say he has the power to make a order a hearing before the High Court and thus skip the whole committal proceeding in the lower courts, which takes up enormous time. I would also advocate that he had the power to make certain civil orders, because usually when these collapses occur, Pyramid Building Society was a good case in Victoria, there are all these cross claims between various groups because money's been shuffled around them with no thought to proprietorship or ownership of any sort, and he can make orders at the moment saying, this goes there, this goes there, this goes there, and make a common element out of it, rather than have individual receivers for each company in the group all fighting actions amongst each other and squandering money that might otherwise go back to the depositors or shareholders. And so that was the principal thing. Even without that, which I think would be the best reform we could see, but I'm a voice in the wilderness, the law otherwise is about as adequate as we are going to get at the moment. I can't read it anymore. I used to understand the 1961 Companies Act, and I could even recite bits of it. But today, a kangaroo couldn't jump over the modern corporations law, and you've got no chance of understanding it. But the law, as I understand it, is enough. We have enough law around the place. We do not need more law. What we need is effective prosecution of that law. When they take 3 years to even get Simon Hannis in the box on what I thought was the clearest case of insider trading I've ever seen in my life, something is very badly wrong with the legal system. Oh, sorry, we've got a microphone back here. I think possession is 9/10.
Ray Wood from Professional Public Relations. It used to be said that the time to get out of a stock was when it was being tipped by lift boys and taxi drivers. But now that lifts are automated and English-speaking taxi drivers are an endangered species, where do we go for information?
Well, I'd hesitate to say the financial press. We're usually half a lap behind anyway, and if we knock something these days, it usually goes up.
I'm now fully empowered, but my mouth's full of apple crumble. Ian Gould from Normandy. I wonder if you could give us your impressions of how the Australian new wave of bold riders will differ from those in the rest of the Western world. The sort of difference between Ned Kelly and his armour and Jesse James, perhaps, in the West.
Well, I must say, it seems to all be done fairly legal these days. If I could just read over a bit. In almost every case, the directors pocketed huge sums in fees and vendor considerations, even though anyone of average intelligence must have known these companies were not operating profitably. That was the 1890s I was talking about. In the 1990s, we did not seem to be far removed from the same paradigm, except instead of real estate subdivisions in Narrowarren, we're now talking about IT stocks, which, because people don't really understand them, they've gone up in the past, are going to keep on going up in the future. What the Bill Gateses of Australia are going to do, I don't know, but they've got an awful lot of money under their control at this stage. Whether they can make profits out of what they are doing, I do not know. I strongly suspect not. By and large, that is. Some lucky ones will get through. What their personal tastes on, whether it runs to Monte Carlo, Grand Cayman, or mistresses, will depend on how they spend their money. They'll probably have much better tax advice than their forebears, and so I doubt whether the ATO will ever get its hands on any of it.
Robert Ferguson from Deloitte, Trevor. Just wonder if you have any comments on the Asian crisis, in particular events in Korea, Thailand and Indonesia, and perhaps some analogies, and any comment on whether Australia will feel the impact in due course.
takes me a bit more out of my brief today in an area where I would not consider myself an expert by any means. And so this is very much an offhand opinion, and I'm prepared to believe that anyone at this lunch has got a more worthy opinion than mine, but the Asian crisis has now been going on for 2 years anyway, and if we were going to feel it, I would have thought we'd have felt it by now. I thought the first mob affected would have been BHP, being great iron and coal exporters. They've copped a few blows, but they weathered it, even though there's been downturns in Japanese steel capacity. They seem to be coping with it fairly well. I'm not convinced that we are going to get out of it as badly as we first thought. On the relative strengths of those economies, I keep on getting told that their banking systems needs repairing. I would be rather bullish about Japan and Korea. I know there are problems there that have to be faced. They're very dedicated people and they're capable of turning themselves around. China, I would not be so confident about. I believe that what they do to their economic statistics is much the same as they do to their female swimmers. They are distorted beyond recognition. And I have little confidence. For the rest of Asia, barring India, I do think that they are, if you like, hitchhikers. If Japan, mainly, and Korea, secondarily, do not go well, I can't see the rest of Southeast Asia going well. And Indonesia, I would think, is a particular worry. I was in Singapore at the start of this year and heard a very interesting address by the CEO of the overseas bank there. It's one of the larger institutions. And he said the Asia crisis had occurred and they'd roughed that through and they'd taken a bit of a hit, but they're okay. What he was really concerned about was the possibility of a civil war in Indonesia. And indeed, maybe not one civil war in Indonesia, because if you have a look in Indonesia, it's a very loose coalition of a lot of different nations whose only common characteristics is that they were once colonised by the Dutch, and in the case of East Timor, not even the Dutch. The Timorese have nothing to do with Java and Sumatra. Bali, as we all know, have travelled there. The Balinese are Hindu and are a different race to the Indonesians. They're not even the same colour. And they're right next door. The Dayaks of Borneo have been going around actively murdering the settlers there from Indonesia, and so have the Orientalese. That is a coalition that could fall apart very easily. And in Singapore and Malaysia, what they're mostly concerned about is a flood of refugees going their way. And I think the largest single concern in Australia today is not what I've been talking about, but the thought of what we're going to do if a flood of Indonesian refugees of one kind or another come our way. But that's my only thoughts, and they're very inexpert.
We're a shy lot, the media today. I've got a couple of questions. First of all, are we going to get Christopher Skase back? And if we do, what on earth are we going to do with him? And secondly, and more important, are the Crows going to beat Port on Sunday?
I'll leave the pain for one more second. I don't think we're likely to get Chris Skase back because, as I understand it, the way the situation goes is that Spain is only proposing to get rid of him, and that's to wherever else he can be sent, which is most likely somewhere like Andorra or France, and it won't be here. If he does get back here, and very few people seem to rehearse this, what is he actually going to be charged with? Now, I used to be, and the accent there is I used to be, a friend of Christopher Skase. I employed him twice, as more than anyone else in this country ever did, or anyway. I taught him to type. That was one of the high points of my career. But he's not up on very many charges, and it's been frequently said they'd be rather embarrassed if he lobbed. It's one of these things like fox hunting. The pursuit is more fun than the actual quarry. I I mean, there's a couple of charges outstanding on Chris. One is that he pocketed all those management fees. Well, in the first place, very little of the management fees actually went to him. The way the corporate ladder was structured, the fees went into the upstream company, which was his, but that was heavily financed by the Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank and Trico to maintain those shareholdings, and he had to have the fees coming up so that he could pay the interest bill on what he owed them, and so it all went in and went out again and was pre-committed, I believe, in some cases. Whether it was illegal for it to be sent up there would depend upon whether the independent directors on Quintex agreed to it or not. And you can't keep something off the record in front of this many press people, but I believe that's a very open question. Okay? I think their best case would be a technical one that he was being financed to maintain a holding in his own company's shares, which really does get a bit technical, and that's about the best they can do against him. But that's my understanding of it. No one has ever enunciated a proper case against Case for me, except he's over there, he's flamboyant, he's thumbed his nose, and they want to get him just to show they can get him. The Crows have got to play better than they did against Sydney. I saw that game. Now, right, I'm a Crow. I barrack for them in both grand finals. They've had two flags. That's very nice. There's a Sydney side, and now he likes to watch a game of footy occasionally. I wouldn't mind if Sydney got into the finals and did well this year. So I was giving the Sydney a bit of a nudge this weekend. I never saw them play better. I never saw the Crows play worse. I mean, I was astounded afterwards to find that Ricciuto and Jarman had been given 12 possessions each. For the effect they had on the ground, they might as well have stayed in the showers. For the port and those who don't. I don't. I'm for the Crows.
There you go. I'd just like to ask a slightly philosophical question. Like Trevor, I've been in Singapore quite recently, and I was going along on a bus past one of the big cinemas there, and they were about to show the world premiere of Rogue Trader, the story of Nick Leeson, who managed to break Barings Bank single-handedly. Trevor, is it true that the bigger the heist, the less likely they are to get caught initially? I mean, what's the sort of feeling about that? What's your feeling?
I'm not sure whether that's totally true. We're talking about Nick Leeson and Barings here. What is true is that Barings were organised so that it was almost inevitable this was going to happen. They had two different kinds of organisation, a matrix they called it. They had one organisation working geographic, so that the Singapore boss controlled Singapore. They had one organisation working functional, so that the futures trading was controlled by the futures trading. The Singapore boss who so Nick Leeson had two bosses. We all know what divided control can do. The Singapore boss of Nick Leeson, who was the one who lived with him, didn't know anything about futures trading. The futures trading boss lived in London, where he was more concerned with boardroom politics and didn't know what was happening in Singapore. This was a recipe for disaster. I would have thought Barings could have put that one up a lot longer, a lot earlier, because Nick was reporting all these huge profits he was making, but every time it was also asking, can they pump in another $5 or $10 million overnight? I would have seen a warning bell somewhere, but that apparently didn't go through his bosses. That just went out the Treasury as a requirement, and so they were draining Barings dry to keep him funded. It was a lack of proper control, and what derivatives really do, as opposed to all the other systems we've ever known, there's no particular magic in derivatives. The only thing is that management control in derivatives has to be much more acute and time sensitive, and it's online and it's now, because if you get it wrong, suddenly you're out of business and a 400-year-old bank gets sent down by some bloke from Watford. And that is how it happened.
Thanks very much. I'm going to wind up my part of these proceedings now and ask Sue if she'll finish off the lunch, and so we can finish in 5 minutes at our traditional time of 2 o'clock. So thank you all for coming, and thank you very warmly to Trevor Sykes. It's always our tradition to give our guest speakers a magnum of Orlando St Hugo Coonawarra Cabernet, 93 I think it is, and it's a great wine. So thanks, Trevor, and Sue, over to you.